Well, they're going to look at the importance of the evidence to the case, whether the evidence was cumulative. And if there's anything that's most important for you, it's that word cumulative. Whether the evidence was cumulative of other evidence. If that inspector's the only testimony in that trial and it was improperly admitted, yeah, they're going to reverse that one. But if it was just another piece, as in number three, the presence or absence of other evidence corroborating or contradicting the evidence on material points, and the overall strength of the state's case. So how much evidence was there really in this case to convict the defendant? And let's look at that in the context of this one statement that you allowed in split-second time. And just to make it a little bit better, the crim apps also said, any other factors also consider any other factor in the record that may shed light on the probable impact of the trial court's error. So the question is, you can make the error, but is it harmless? And is it harmless when you look at all the evidence in the case? So sure, a victim may be quoted, she's not there, there was no cross-examination, it doesn't come in any other way, but it comes in because you let it in. Error, sure. But then you've got the police officer who, let's say, was there and saw the events. It's not going to be reversed. Or let's say there are three or four people there that saw what evidence you allowed in violation of Crawford. The cumulative evidence overcomes that. To me, that's the important part of what you need to know about Crawford. And to the extent that the rest of this is, I think, just interesting history, some of you may choose to read or kind of listen to this. It was a small world back in the 1300s and 1600s. And the concept of confrontation is deeply rooted in history. Deuteronomy. Whoops. Get back there. These four sections talking about bearing false witness, talking about both men being judged. The Romans required confrontation. So the concept of I get to ask you questions. I can get in your face. Has been around for a long, long time. This is not something new. And it's certainly not new with the colonies. The colonies, though, as you'll see, put some icing on the cake. Again, what do these have in common? Municipalities, municipal judges. It's fascinating where you guys and ladies came from and how you played a part in this concept of confrontation. The case itself has a lot of history in it. And so, no, I didn't just kind of take the excerpts out of Crawford and the text out of Crawford. I actually did a little bit of looking and reading. Municipalities were actually born. Your job was born in 1157. Lincolnshire Town Charter. Remember, these are the Dark Ages. We're all serfs. We're groveling and eating dirt and bark and plants. A free city, able to make many of its own laws, limited taxing authority, residence for a year and a day, and no claims being made against you, made you a free man, not obligated to defend your freedom. An extraordinary event in history and in law. We were all serfs. Somebody owned us. Somebody owned us. But if you could get to Lincolnshire and you were good for a year, you were home free. Municipal judges, what you used to do. Originally, justices of the peace. And what you did was very much like you do today, an examining trial. What you do today as an examining trial under, 1601? Is the same as your predecessors in 1157. Almost word for word. You would hear or take testimony in common law and civil trials, and I'll explain that. You were usually a gentleman of means, selected for status and probity, not legally trained. You understood the local problems. You knew personally the parties and their stature. Pretty interesting stuff. I think it's still like that in Midland, for the most part. And if there's somebody from Midland, oh well, Robin's not here. But again, look at the context of what you did. You conducted examining trials, just like you do today. Many of you in this room are legally trained, but originally you weren't. You were kind of the respected individual in town. You knew everybody. You knew who was good and who was bad. You essentially, in civil cases, presided over ex parte trials. And this is where it starts to get more interesting. You did your examining trial, and then at the district court level, then called the shire court, the district judge would call you up and say, "Judge, tell me what happened when you interviewed the defendant." And you would recharacterize the testimony that was given to you. You might add your own nuances, your comments, knowing what his family or her family was, how he related to the other parties. Problem was, he wasn't able to contradict what you said. Or it might be just a witness who you are recounting the testimony of. That witness wasn't there. The defendant couldn't question you. You're the lower court judge. Now, in English civil trials, civil matters were crown pleas. And that's where the deposition and interrogatory comes from. What we do today. We still call ourselves, oddly enough, criminal lawyers and civil lawyers. And we've been doing it since about the 1200s. In civil matters, everything was done by deposition interrogatory. To you, as the judge, you repeated it in the civil matter almost entirely to the district court, if in fact you didn't decide it on your own. Common pleas, those were the criminal matters. And very often, the same thing would occur. You, as the judge, would help conduct the examining trial, and then either, if it was a misdemeanor typically, you would go ahead and render punishment, or if it was a felony, and really there were most everything was a felony back then you would go ahead and repeat it to the shire judge. Masons will disagree about the dates here, plus or minus. I mean, you know, it's, 600 years ago. The guy's dead. Jacques de Molay. Think about the Crusades, the Templar Knights, Arthur, Marian. They were basically monk soldiers sworn to protect pilgrims to the Holy Land. And we're still paying for it today in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Just a comment. But so little has changed, really, in terms of this subject. That's, to me, what's interesting. These folks, the Grand Master Knights Templar, amassed enormous wealth. They were, if you will, the mercenaries of the Pope. And they were paid, and they paid themselves handsomely. Remember, the Middle Ages was a time of superstition. And Pope Innocent and King Philip of France wanted, well, they owed the Knights Templar big bucks. Templars weren't really loan sharking, but they were the treasury for the continent at that time. And what's the best way to eradicate a debt? Pay it off or kill the guy you owe it to. Worked for them. So the Pope and the King decided that the Templars were heretics. And they went through the typical, the rack and the burning and all the bad stuff that you read about. They kept de Molay in prison for about 7 years as they rid the country of all his soldiers. At that point, there were some political reasons why they wanted to essentially cleanse themselves of this situation. And they offered a plea bargain. Hey, we didn't originate this stuff. They said, look, Jacques, publicly admit that you did these bad things, and we'll give you a life sentence. So, Jacques says, okay, I'll do it. They get a crowd of folks together one day for the occasion to hear the head of the Knights Templar admit his transgressions. However, what happens in a loud, clear voice, he retracts his confession and insists before God he had lied only to protect the order and its members from torture. He is said to have said, the thought of dying is not so awful that I shall confess four times, which have never been committed, four crimes have never been, etc. At such a price, life is not worth having. And the Pope and the King said, He is also, just as the flames were beginning to do their damage, to have shouted out a curse against both Philip and the Pope. He was joined that day by Geoffrey de Charnay, who was the Templar precept. He also declined and renounced. They both essentially became crispy critters right then and there. No room. Remember, the Middle Ages was a superstitious time. In little more than a month, Clement died of lupus. 8 months later, Philip, at the early age of 46, perished by an accident while hunting with a descendant of former VP Dick Cheney. I don't know your political thoughts, but you know, I was reading this stuff and I thought, history really does repeat itself. You know, he actually got shot with an arrow, but hey, you know, small world. Again, this stuff just didn't come out of nowhere. And that is the origin of the dying declaration. That is the first hearsay exception and its origin. Two crusaders becoming crispy critters and saying, this is the truth, and it is because I believe in God and I'm about to be burned. And by the way, a pox on your house. And gosh, it happened. He must have been telling the truth. So while the Tiguas were kind of hanging out here long before the conquistadors got here, European descendants were back at this. Now that takes us to Sir Walter Raleigh. And aside from being the face on the blue can with the tobacco that we all bought as kids but couldn't roll, he had a piece in this, along with Devereux, the second Earl of Essex. 1603, Raleigh's alleged to have conspired against the king by a Lord Cobham. Cobham implicated Raleigh in a letter and in testimony before the Privy Council, which was like the Supreme Court. Both his letters, both Cobham's letters and testimony were used against Raleigh. Despite Raleigh's repeated request to face Cobham, because he knew Cobham so well, he knew he was a weenie, and he could have broken him. Well, Raleigh didn't quite get it, and was executed. Devereux was sort of, I guess, a bit of a stud. half the age of the queen, who enjoyed his flirtations, but played only within her age group. And I omit the other bullet points that go into that, but thinking that he was such a cool dude, he ignored military orders from the queen and was put under house arrest for conspiracy to overthrow the queen. In comes Coke and Bacon. Those of you who are law school attendees, you know, how many of you read Coke and Bacon? I mean, it's like, gag. Coke on the left, Bacon on the right. Coke prosecuted Devereux and Raleigh. And Coke was kind of like your rabid prosecutor on steroids on a bad day. Or trying to be unisexual, your worst ex-spouse. He was so bad that he was finally removed as Chief Justice, in part because while he was so bad or so aggressive in his examination, he ultimately, in another case, voted against letting the king do whatever he wanted and became our first libertarian. Interesting. Bacon was, I guess we'd call him a sleazeball today, slick and manipulative. He gave Raleigh softball questions. But he utilized all that ex parte. He was described at the time as unctuous and double-minded in his survivalist mode, kind of like Wally, who was it? Leave it to Beaver. There was Beaver, Wally, and Eddie Haskell. Okay? He was Eddie Haskell. Now, where does Shakespeare come into this? Funny stuff. It's a small world back then. Coke and Shakespeare were contemporaries. Interesting fact. Shakespeare was almost caught up in the Essex affair because he mingled with these folks. Shakespeare's father was a town bailiff, which was similar to the sheriff. Shakespeare is believed to have studied law, and there are actually 318 legal words and phrases in 33 of his plays, sonnets, and poems. At a time when most folks couldn't read, let alone know the law, there's old Willie with an extraordinary insight into the politics and law of the day. By the way, Ducharnay comes around again in the last 30 years. It was Ducharnay, interestingly enough, who was the first known possessor of the Shroud of Turin. And it has been in his family ever since and is, in fact, on loan to wherever it is today from the Ducharnay family. So it's really a small world back then. Now, the right to confrontation matures. About the time the Tiguas decided that they were going to revolt against the conquistadors, confrontation took a big step. Partly because of Raleigh, partly because of Devereux, and historically, 300 years earlier, the Dying Declaration. Statements started to become admitted only if witnesses, between accusers and the accused, statements admitted only if a witness demonstrably unavailable, suspect's confession could be used only against himself. In fact, in treason cases, it couldn't even be used against him. It had to be cumulative to other live testimony. So here you notice, in Texas, our harmless error rule 44-2A, you know, we stole it from the Brits from 1661. By 1696, a dead witness's examinations were excluded because the statement was taken before a mayor without the defendant present. So it was maturing well. Now this is interesting. The colonial period, offenses under the Stamp Act, these were tried as civil cases by deposition. The king actually changed the law from the criminal law, common law, to get the colonists by making the Stamp Act an admiralty act, hence civil, hence depositions and interrogatories, no confrontation. That's one of the things that pissed everybody off in 1765. And one of the folks that upset most was a defense lawyer, John Adams. Adams said, examination of witnesses upon interrogatories are only by the civil law, and Englishmen and common lawyers have an aversion to them, if not an abhorrence of them. So, chances are, he'd be a member of Texas Criminal Defense Lawyers Association today. James Madison, interesting guy. He was actually the author of the Sixth Amendment. Believed in confrontation. Believed in unrestricted right to counsel at any proceeding. And, this is important, a right to a copy of the indictment. Because under English common law, you haven't heard me say, well, there was the confrontation clause where you got to cross-examine, and there was the right to know what you were charged with. Didn't happen that way, even in criminal law. You never got to see what you were charged with. You heard it at the time you were tried, but you never really got a formal notice. Madison was very, very upset about that. The Boston Tea Party, not the one that's going on today, but the Boston Tea Party was planned at the Green Dragon Tavern, also known as the Freemason Arms, in the headquarters of the Revolution. John Adams was a Freemason. James Madison was thought to have been. So here we go from De Molay in 1307, wheedling our way up 400 years, four centuries, and the same fundamental players are in the game. And this is an interesting fact. A survey of 363 prosecutions between 1720 and 1740 showed that 57% resulted in no judgment at all because of a lack of persons to give evidence. One of our original judicial administrative records. And in colonial New York, 37% of the prosecutions were never resolved, with that rate being over 50% in some parts of the colony. We were taking the concept of confrontation very, very seriously. Very seriously. And so when you look at the Sixth Amendment, you have to realize, in granting a full right to counsel in all cases and to be informed of the charge against you, does not duplicate common law. It actually expands it dramatically. That's what makes the Constitution such a unique document. It actually grew the concepts and joined them in the Sixth Amendment. Because up until then, and I didn't put some slides in, but between 1307, 1600, and 1765, 1771, you had a series of exceptions to the hearsay rule, exceptions to confrontation. And up until Crawford, those were the rules in play. If the exception was reasonable and reliable, i.e., the dying declaration, if the exception was reasonable, well, then we ought to be able to think it's reliable. Now, we still have reliability, but as you'll see in a minute, notwithstanding the death of the witness and whatever the respectability of the court taking the depositions, weight of the testimony, such depositions are ex parte. It was very, very firmly in the state laws around the country. You had a right to face your accuser. And let's come back now around to Crawford. The court rejected the concept of admissibility based on firmly rooted exceptions and thought to bear particularized qualities, guarantees of trustworthiness. It said these principles held true for Cobham's statements and Raleigh's trial. In other words, my God, if he told the truth in letters to Raleigh, if he told the truth to the Privy Council, well, that's certainly reliable. But that's not the heart of the question. But the issue was that those judges refused to let Raleigh cross-examine Cobham. To reach the clause's ultimate goal of reliability requires that reliability be tested by cross-examination. This is the rule, net-net, bottom line, of Crawford. We get away from the intellect, we get away from my other two colleagues who wrote those wonderful papers, and we get down to kind of good old common sense and the Knights and John Adams. The best way to test reliability is to cross-examine. Ex parte in court testimony or ex functional equivalent, that is, material such as affidavits, custodial examinations, prior testimony, unable to cross-examine, or similar pretrial statements, these reasonably expected to be used prosecuted. Extrajudicial statements, all of this stuff is out. Statements that were made under circumstances which will lead an objective witness reasonably to believe that the statement would be available for use at a later trial. They're out, unless that person is there and can be cross-examined. In 206, Davis v. Hammond expanded this a little bit. We started to talk about the Confrontation Clause of 9/11 tapes. And we started to refine this testimonial, non-testimonial. Non-testimonial, when made in the course of police interrogation, under circumstances objectively indicating that the primary purpose of interrogation is to enable police assistance to meet an ongoing emergency. They're testimonial when the circumstances objectively indicate that there is no such ongoing emergency. So that's how we analyzed the 911 calls. Very, very simple. Melendez-Diaz in 09, where the Confrontation Clause applies to certificates by analysts that drug tested was cocaine, held certificates or affidavits, which fall within the core class of testimonial statements. What could be more written for the purpose of future litigation than the affidavit that goes along with the document? Now, since then, we have 3841. A lot of people wondered why this came along when it did. But we have effectively made it possible for those statements to come in. That is, under these circumstances. And who was that last face? It was Soupy Sales as George Washington. And by the way, Soupy was a Mason also. So, for better or for worse, that's how we got around to Confrontation Clause today and Crawford. And the fact that you've been able to endure this in a room without air conditioning gives you some idea of how important it should be to you, because you have sweat equity in the Sixth Amendment now. And I want to thank you all. I would take questions, but we could play the game of, well, what if it was this, and what if it was that, and let's second-guess one another. It's a tough evidentiary issue on a good day. But if you look at it in the context that it was originally created, which is the best way to know whether this statement is worth a darn is to be able to cross-examine a person or to know that it was given at a time when the defendant could have cross-examined them. I want to thank you all for bearing with this, and hope the rest of your day works out well and your stay here in El Paso is a good one.